Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Friday, August the 12th, and welcome to our commentary. Just a quick heads up, on Friday night, we're going to be recording a podcast with our friend George Rodriguez, and we'll have that up Friday night and for the entire weekend. I'll put it up on my Facebook page as well, so you can listen to it. And we'll be talking about what's happening in South Texas, a lot of interesting things always happening down there, what's happening in Texas in general. And we're going to talk about this incident with Beto O'Rourke. I have a post about this coming out Saturday morning. But as you may have heard, Beto O'Rourke was campaigning, and he was talking about the AR-15. And he was doing what a lot of liberals do, which is to incorrectly talk about the AR-15. He was demonizing the AR-15 as a military weapon and a weapon that was made for the Vietnam War, which is ridiculous. I mean, that's just totally ignorance on the part of Beto. The AR-15 has nothing to do with the Vietnam War or any military. But anyway, somebody shouted something at him, and he turned around and said something that I cannot repeat on the podcast, but it starts with the letter M, and in the middle there's the letter F, so mother, you know what. And of course, that's gotten a lot of publicity. I'm not sure if this was a setup, meaning somebody set him up for this, or whether this was natural. I don't know. I don't really care. But it has put, to say the least, Beto O'Rourke in the news. He's been doing a lot of campaigning across the state, and it put him in the news, not in a most favorable way. But when you are Beto O'Rourke, you need publicity, because obviously this is going to be a very tough election for him in November. So I have a post about this, and we'll talk about it more with George. George has been following the Beto O'Rourke campaign much closely, because a lot of it is happening down there in the San Antonio, Central Texas area, and that's where Beto has been campaigning. So we'll talk to George about that. And we're also going to talk about the raid on President Trump's home. And that's the main topic today that I want to get into with you, because I want to tell you what I think happened. Now, this is my opinion. This is not based on any inside information. I don't have any access to the FBI, to the Department of Justice, to the Trump campaign. I'm just going to tell you what I think happened and why I think this is going to be very conflictive and very difficult, very, very difficult for the Attorney General and ultimately the Biden administration. One of the things that has characterized the Democrats during the Trump presidency, and especially now that he's out of power, is what many of us have referred to as Trump derangement syndrome. And that is simply an obsession with Trump, this obsession with getting Trump, that you got to get Trump, you got to get Trump, you got to get Trump. Now, this is not the first time in politics that, a group has been obsessed with another politician. It's happened before. But of course, now, because of social media and all of that, it gets a lot more attention. But the Democrats have been trying to get Trump for, frankly, ever since he decided to run for president. They had the Russia thing that turned out to be a joke. We know that people within the FBI were talking about his campaign in a way that was completely unprofessional for members of the FBI. So to say that some people in the Democrat Party or in the federal government have been out to get Trump is a little bit, a bit of an understatement. Of course they have. And I think what all of this started with the January 6th committee, and this is my theory, so sit back and listen to my theory. I think a lot of Democrats were hoping that the January 6th committee would not necessarily convict Trump of a crime, but would turn public opinion against Trump. They were going to say a lot of things about him, like the story that he was, trying to take the steering wheel from a Secret Service agent, which is ridiculous if you know anything about, the situation. It's completely ridiculous. By the way, it's a story that the Secret Service has denied, and they're willing to go on record to deny it. But the committee, of course, is not going to put them on because they don't want to crash the narrative. But I think a lot of Democrats invested themselves a great deal that the January 6th committee was going to at least turn public opinion against President Trump. So they had these hearings, they had all these incredible stories, but the reality is that it has not. In fact, a poll by the Mammoth Organization just came out a few days ago saying that 90% of the country has not changed their opinions whatsoever about January the 6th. In other words, if you, like me, thought that the whole thing had not blown out of proportion, but certainly the attacks on Trump were blown out of proportion, then you feel the same way. And if you're a Democrat and you think they should hang Trump from a tree, you think the same way. The situation, politically speaking, the January 6th committee has not done anything to change the political situation in the country. So now the Democrats are running out of time because everything's going to change after the elections in November. When the Republicans take over the House, the January 6th committee is going to change. It probably will cease to exist. And if it does exist, it'll be with a different focus. It's going to be more on looking at the big picture, such as why wasn't the Capitol protected? So the Democrats realize that the clock is working against them. So apparently somebody told them that there was a document in the Florida home of former President Trump, that there was a document there that was very, very serious. So they went to a judge. Now, they looked for a judge, you know, what they like to call, you go shopping for a judge. So you look for the one judge more likely or most likely to sign your warrant. So they found this very liberal judge in Florida who signed off on it. And then they went into the house of the former president. First of all, if they thought there was a document in President Trump's or former President Trump's possession, the smartest and the easiest way to get that document, again, the smartest and the easiest way would have been to go through the courts. And even if you have to go to the Supreme Court and issue a subpoena, and the Supreme Court very likely would defend the subpoena and tell President Trump that he's got to give up the document. Just a little history on the side here. You all remember the Nixon tapes back in the summer of 1974, when President Nixon had some tapes and the tapes were requested. He didn't want to give them up. So they went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, you have to give them up. And he did. He had to. So the same thing would have happened here. The courts would have eventually forced President Trump to give up whatever document they say he was not supposed to have. Now, the other thing going on here, too, is that there were negotiations between the Trump people and whatever the name of the organization is that keeps these records. So they were talking. The idea that he was not cooperating with them is not true. So anyway, so here we have time is the clock is ticking, and you have an administration basically made up of people who are obsessed with Trump. I mean, they just cannot spend 2 minutes of their life without talking about Trump. So they figured, let's go in there, let's grab this document, and then we got him. Well, it's not turning out that way. In fact, I think most people are reacting the way I am, and I think even many Democrats would probably tell you that this is a very stupid thing to do. Because for one thing, we've never done that before in the United States. We've never broken into the house of a former president, you know, especially not over documents. I mean, my gosh, I mean, presidents in the past have had problems with documents, but we never go to this extreme. So I think that they must have thought that there was something in there that they could pull out and then embarrass President Trump with it. I don't think there is. I will tell you this right now. No, I'm taking a leap here when I say this because I have not seen the documents. But judging by the way that the attorney general looked on TV a couple of days ago, or yesterday, I guess, judging by the body language of that man, I don't think he's got anything. And I think he looked to me scared to death because I don't think they do. And even if they do, it's not going to be a document that justifies anywhere near this reaction of going into his home and breaking in and allegedly going through the former first lady's closets, and you know, which is of course, that's a pretty crazy thing to do. So that's my guess, that I think they thought this is our last chance. We got to go in. We got to get this document. And now they find themselves in deep trouble. I don't think there's going to be a document that they're going to find, or a document that certainly would justify this level of an intervention in the former president's house. I think what's going to happen is that the Biden administration is going to look pretty silly after all of this. I believe that the attorney general will be fired, if not resigned. So will the director of the FBI. And this is going to turn out to be a very, very embarrassing chapter in the Biden administration. And the one thing that I think it has done is it has illuminated people as to the risk of the so-called deep state. You know, when the FBI can do something like this and use a document to get into even a former president's house, that's a pretty scary thing to do. The other thing, too, that I cannot believe that they didn't think this at the White House. This is what I was talking a minute ago about Trump derangement syndrome, that when you get into that kind of obsession point of, I mean, when your mind is obsessed with somebody, you tend to do a lot of stupid things, and because you're not thinking logically. And it amazes me there wasn't anybody around the attorney general who said, Mr. Attorney General, I understand what you're trying to do, but this is going to be very risky politically to do. Let's not do this. Let's try to go through the courts and find the document. I'm amazed that nobody said that to him. And if they said that to him, I'm amazed that he didn't listen to that point of view, because what the attorney general has done by authorizing this entry into the president's home, frankly, is to make things a lot worse. So that's I'm not basing this on any knowledge or inside knowledge. Nobody obviously has called me and told me what's going on. I'm just looking at the situation, a combination of Trump derangement syndrome with a clock ticking against the January 6th committee and a bunch of Democrats obsessed with Trump. And I think when you put it all together, you get some people who do some stupid things. And that's what this is all about. This was a very stupid thing. And I will predict to you, I know I'm going out on the limb here, and I know that, I may regret saying what I'm about to say, but I'll go ahead and say it. I believe that the attorney general's days are gone. I think he's got, he'll be around for a while, but he's not going to be there very long. The White House is distancing itself from the attorney general. The poor guy was left alone. And you're not hearing anything from Joe Biden in support of the attorney general. I mean, it's total silence from the White House. So the attorney general is on his own on this. And President Trump, who's a brilliant strategist, is obviously going to come back and say, if I was President Trump, I would say, okay, there's nothing there. Prove me wrong. And I believe that that's what's going to happen. So that's why, my story is the way it is. It's just my opinion. I'm not basing this on anybody's, I don't have any sources or anything like that. I'm just looking at the facts and telling you that when you combine Trump derangement syndrome with a January 6th committee that is not producing anything and a bunch of people who are obsessed with Trump, what you get is a bunch of people who make stupid decisions, like breaking into the former president's home and, crashing a tradition that has never, we've never had this happen before. And believe me, and I'm sure my friend Sally, who's a history teacher, I'm sure she knows that we've had political passions before. This is not the first time that the president and the outgoing president don't like each other. We've had worse cases like that in American history. So it's like, come on, there've been very bad political passions in the past, but never, never was something like this done to go after a former president. So anyway, that's my prediction. That's what I think is going to happen. That's why I think it happened the way it happened. And we'll see. I guess you can check with me in about 30 days and tell me I'm right or I'm wrong. But I think this was a stupid mistake made by a bunch of people who are hysterical about Trump. And they're going to pay the ultimate price. I think the attorney general will be gone and the director of FBI will be gone and the Biden presidency will be hurt even more than it is already. Now, I'll say one last thing, just as they say, just a footnote. All of this, I could be proven 100% wrong if next week they come up with a document where, they show that Donald Trump was violating, something. But I don't see it. I honestly don't. I don't see that. What I see is there may be documents, but none of it rises to the level of criminality that would justify what we have just seen. So check out my chat with with George Rodriguez on Friday night on the podcast. We're going to talk about Texas, and we're going to talk a little bit about the raid on President Trump's home. So thank you for listening. Everybody have a wonderful day, and we'll talk to you later. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas. Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Monday, August the 8th, and welcome to our commentary. Just a quick reminder that later on we will be recording our podcast with Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda, and we will be reviewing many of the events of the week, as we always like to do. The recording will be available on my blog, and I also put it on my Facebook page and also on Blog Talk Radio, of course. You can get the actual link of the podcast. Sometimes people put it up on Twitter so that you may be able to find it over there. But we'll talk about a lot of issues that are in the news this day. But today I want to remember two things that happened on August the 8th. And they didn't happen that long ago. So most of you should have a memory of what I'm about to relate. The first one was August the 8th, 1974. And that was the night that President Nixon resigned the presidency, or spoke to the nation, saying that he was going to be resigning the presidency effective the next day at noon. So that speech, of course, was the last chapter, if you will, of the Watergate story that began in June of 1972 when a bunch of people broke into the Democrat Party headquarters in Washington, D.C. at the Watergate building. That's where the word Watergate come from. There was a building named Watergate. I think it's still there in Washington, D.C. I think it's a complex of office buildings there in the nation's capital. So a bunch of people broke in. Initially, it was just a local police story, nothing of consequence. It had absolutely no impact on the 1972 elections because Richard Nixon went on to be reelected by 49 states. He also got 61 or 62% of the popular vote. It was one of the biggest popular vote margins ever in an American president, but he was reelected easily. He ran against George McGovern, Senator George McGovern, whose main issue was the Vietnam War. But the problem is, by the time people voted in November, by the time we got to the first Tuesday of November and people went out to vote, the war was over. Richard Nixon, President Nixon, had basically taken the American involvement from 500,000 when he came in to about 20,000 or so on election day. So the war was no longer an issue. We were not losing men in Vietnam as we did for several years. So the war was really not an issue. So McGovern's number one issue, the anti-war movement, was kind of a dead issue by the time people voted. So Richard Nixon was reelected, as I say, in huge margins. Now, the Watergate thing began to happen in 1973 when the investigation began, and they found a connection between the people who broke in. These people had a connection to the Nixon reelection committee. Nixon himself was never involved in this. There's no evidence that he even knew about this, but it was some people around him who knew about it and probably should have been fired immediately. Had Richard Nixon fired these people in 1972 or 1973, he probably would have been spared the whole investigation and the scandal. But, you know, he protected his people and in doing so participated in the cover-up. So to make a long story short, by this week in 1974, Richard Nixon had to release some tapes that he had. These were tapes made of conversations inside the Oval Office between the president and his aides and so on. And obviously, there was some bad information in those tapes. So once those tapes were released, there was no way that he could survive politically. So the first few days of August 1974, a group of Republican senators went to the Oval Office and said, look, you know, we cannot guarantee that you'll survive the impeachment vote. And we cannot guarantee that you'll survive in the Senate if it gets to the Senate. So Richard Nixon made a calculation. He decided to resign. So he went on national television on this day in 1974 and told the nation that he was resigning, again, effective the next day. The whole thing was very historic because we had never seen anything like this before. We had never seen an American president resign. But it was also more historic because the man who became president now, Gerald Ford, was not elected himself. Remember, the 1972 ticket was Richard Nixon and Spiro Agnew as vice president. But Spiro Agnew had to resign the vice presidency in October of 1973 because of some scandals in his home state of Maryland. So you had as vice president Gerald Ford, who had been appointed by the president and approved by the Congress. So we were literally, you know, navigating through historic times. You know, a president was resigning, and then on top of that, you have a vice president who was not elected, now becoming president. So the whole thing was very historic, very interesting. For those of you who may not remember, there's a lot of books about Watergate, lots and lots of books about Watergate. We could do another show on that because it's a complicated story. But I'll simply say this. I think Richard Nixon resigning was probably the best thing for him and for the country, because we had to put Watergate behind him. We just had to put Watergate behind us. It was just too much of a drag on the country. So he resigned. Gerald Ford became president. But again, he didn't become president until the next day. The speech was on this day in 1974, and the transfer of power happened on August the 9th at noon, when President Nixon left the White House and President Ford became the president. The whole thing is, you could see it on YouTube if you want to see some of the video of this. It was handled, looking back at it now, it was handled in a very elegant fashion, I think, by both Nixon and Ford. Nixon left the White House that day, took the helicopter, and Ford, you know, walked with him to the helicopter in a very professional and classy way, and then he became president. For those of us who remember this, for those of us who actually saw it on TV, it was history, because, again, this had never happened before. It's like the landing on the moon. We had never seen anything like that before in American history. We had seen vice presidents become presidents because of an assassination or the death of a president, but we had never seen something like this where a president resigned and a new one took over. So it was very historic, very, very historic to watch it on TV. It was one of those things that, you know, hopefully does not happen again. If you want to read something about Watergate, there's a lot of stuff out there that you can read. But one book that I would recommend is Richard Nixon's book. Richard Nixon wrote a memoir of his life, you know, his political life, starting as a congressman in California and all the way to the presidency. And there's a whole section about Watergate that you're going to enjoy a great deal, because I think Richard Nixon was very honest about his shortcomings with respect to Watergate, and I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it, reading that book. It's called Richard Nixon Memoirs, and it's a double edition. There's two books to that. I mean, I don't know. I assume you can get it on Kindle or something like that, but I have, or used to have, the original paper copy. I think I have it somewhere, the original paper copy, and I had a lot of fun reading that book because in many ways, I admired Richard Nixon. I thought he was a brilliant strategist, foreign policy, and so on. But obviously, he made mistakes. And what I liked about him in the end is that he admitted those mistakes and those shortcomings in his memoirs. And then when he passed away in 1994, he was given a full presidential funeral. And as President Clinton said in his funeral, you know, we have to look at the entire record of Richard Nixon, the president. And that's because by the time he passed away in 1994, 20 years after the resignation, people saw him a little different. They saw the Watergate story, of course, you cannot avoid that. But they also saw the foreign policy strategist. And he wrote a bunch of great books after he left the presidency. And he became a foreign policy specialist. And many presidents relied on him. President Reagan, President Bush, even President Clinton relied on him a great deal about, you know, information, especially information about Russia, because he became a real Russia specialist, Richard Nixon, and a man who had a lot to contribute to future presidents. But on this day in 1974, he went on national television and resigned. And I remember the whole thing. It was really historic, to say the least. Well, the other story that we remember on this day, it's a little bit less intense, but it was a lot of fun. On this day in 1988, 1988. So 8-8-88, August the 8th, 1988. They turned on the lights at Wrigley Field. Wrigley Field, of course, the home of the Chicago Cubs, one of the classic baseball stadium of all time. I mean, it's a classic. Wrigley Field in Chicago and Fenway Park in Boston are still pretty much the way they used to be for almost 100 years. And for a long, long time, they didn't have lights at Wrigley Field. If you went into Wrigley Field, you had to play in the afternoon because they didn't have lights. So when the Cubs would play, they would play at noon or at 1 o'clock. That's when they started the games. And that's the way it was. I remember as a new arrival in the United States, you know, living in Wisconsin, that, you know, we would actually pick up the Cubs games on radio, pick them up in the afternoon. And we would be listening to the Cubs game on the way home from school. Or sometimes if we had baseball practice, we had a radio, we were listening to the Cubs games. So it was very convenient to have baseball in the afternoon. But of course, it was not economically sound because eventually television began to dominate. And of course, the big audience for television is in the evening. So they had to change. So on August 8th, 1988, they finally turned on the lights. And I got to see that one too. Now that game, if you remember, that game was actually rained out. They started to play the game. But then they had to rain out the game because they just got this huge downpour of rain. So then they actually had, the game was actually the next day. The whole game was played the next day. But they got to turn on the lights. They got to turn on the lights on this day in 1988. And all of that, of course, was on national television because the game was a big deal. It was a national audience. And there was a gentleman, an old Cubs fan, who actually turned on the lights. Now, I don't know if he was around in 2016 when the Cubs won the World Series, because remember the Cubs went a long time without winning anything. And so I don't know if this gentleman, the one who turned on the lights, got to see the World Series victory in 2016, but it was great. It was great watching that. And now, of course, if you go to play the Cubs, you play in the evening like everybody else does. And, again, I was a huge fan of the afternoon baseball because it suited me real well. When I was a teenager and I was growing up and we would play baseball in the afternoon and we'd be listening to the Cubs games on our little radio. But it didn't make sense economically having all those games in the afternoon. The other problem they had too was the teams that were playing from the West Coast, like the Dodgers and the Giants, who would fly in from the West Coast to play the Cubs, if the game would start at noon Chicago time, it would be like 10 o'clock West Coast time. So those teams were, you got to listen to morning baseball in the West Coast because of Wrigley Field. But everything changed on this day, 8-8-88. Just remember that, 8-8-88. That was the day that the lights went on in Wrigley Field. So a couple of things I wanted to share with you today, a couple of recent events that I remember watching quite well, and many of you probably do as well. The lights went on in Wrigley and President Nixon resigned. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day and we'll talk to you later. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.